ready.
Today is Friday, August 25th, 2023. This is part 21 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Alan Malmquist. Alan spells his name A-L-L-E-N, last name M-A-L-M-Q-U-I-S-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Alan. How are you today?
Good morning, Tom. I'm just fine, thank you.
Great. Alan, may we record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. This morning you sent me a wonderful email with two photos attached to it. One was a picture of Samantha's cabin from 1950, and another was after the work you had done on that. Was that in 2007, that second photo?
2009.
Thank you. Night and day difference. Just amazing. One of the things that caught my eye was the 2009 photo had a porch that the 1950 photo did not. And so I wondered how that porch arrived. Can you fill me in on that?
Right. And the whole thing going on there is a good example of how the buildings are, just their evolution over the years that continues on when the park gets them. They've changed, they're developed, they're restored, their decisions have to be made. But the building there, I believe there could have been a porch before the 50s, but it was not there at the time that was taken. And I know the porch that's there now was put in by the last owners of the ranch and the consortium before the Park Service bought it. And it was discussed and finally decided just to leave the porch and the little patio out in front of the porch to restore that and keep it part of the building there. And the second picture really, to me, is a positive thing of what the Park Service can do, and it certainly wasn't all me, but with several crews coming and renovating the building piece by piece and year by year. And then about I finished up most of what was had been suggested by the historic architects and then maintained it in a way to provide a really good environment there. Because to me, the one thing I could do was work on the setting a little. And I mentioned that I put in the large garden next to it. And that picture shows a little of the corn in the background. I have another picture of the garden that time.
And it shows a nice sort of split rail kind of fence.
Yeah.
As well, and that would be a great place to tie up a horse. There's a wagon that's moved in there. Where did the wagon come from?
Okay, on both the fence and the wagon. First, I'll mention the wagon was donated by the Judd family in Kanab.
Wow.
Who had a big Western souvenir store, very prominent when you drove through Canal.
Okay.
And the judge finally retired. And I knew that they had worked with my friend Mel Heaton when he was organizing and sponsoring wagon train trips from Pipe Springs to St. George.
Okay.
Probably a 3-day, 2-night trip by people could come and recreate the pioneers, and it worked very well. And they ended up with several wagons, and he and his wife came by the ranch one day, and I was visiting with them, and I, in the conversation, not on purpose or thinking getting anything, I mentioned that I really wish we had a wagon here that would demonstrate what the pioneers used when they came through in the 1800s and in the 1880s and 90s and on in till the cars started coming. And he kind of says, oh, I've got one. And that one, I'll just say it was built in northern Utah in the, would have been 1960s or 70s. So it was a basically modern, but all in the old style.
Okay.
And it was used on the honeymoon trail back and forth for several years. So there was that, as long as we're honest about not pretending that was John D. Lee's wagon.
Right.
And it definitely has a lot of interesting details to it, the way it's put together. And it was definitely in the correct style and size and everything. That fence you're talking about was fascinating because that was the first project that I took on when I was still in interpretation and spending, part of the day down there at the ranch. And I asked the archaeologist if there wasn't something I could do. And she looked at the fence that was there, and we have pictures somewhere, but it had been along that space, it had been put up by the park maintenance guy, one of the first ones that after the park bought the building. The old one was rotting away and falling down, and he hauled that all away and built this fence that was really nice, but not appropriate at all. It had stone pillars in a line, sandstone, and mainly petrified wood.
Oh my gosh.
And when you looked at it, you really saw, and it was well done, prominently displaying, how beautiful the petrified wood is around. He had driven up on the benches above the ranch that was, BLM land and
right.
Still collectible, and brought down all this petrified wood, put it in, had pine poles across between it.
Okay.
The two problems, it was not historic at all when we started looking at it. The old pictures showed another fence completely. And the other thing, he did not build these on, he didn't pour foundations for each of the posts, the stone pillars. And so they leaned over one way or the other, got moisture in the middle that froze and popped them apart. And the thing was in almost total ruin, on the way to total ruin.
Okay.
And the archaeologist asked, well, could you see about getting rid of that? And we found the picture of the place in the 1960s, definitely good pictures, that showed the fence that was there, and this was what we were restoring with Samantha's cabin.
Okay.
But what I did was recreate it perfectly. I mean, I looked at the fence carefully, and there was, it was just made out of whatever was left over around the ranch, because there'd be a couple cedar poles, a square, old 4x6, and then there'd be a pine pole and some other cedar poles. And I went around and found replacements for all those different types. So I put them in exactly where there was a cedar pole. I put in a cedar pole. The distance, because they were not even, some were closer together, some were farther apart, and I recreated that. And then the boards that were attached to it, we had a lot of old barn wood stored up in the, what we called the boneyard.
Okay.
And I was able to find boards that duplicated exactly what was there in the original photograph. And I put it up, and everyone felt great. Some people would come back, what happened to the petrified wood? And I said, well, that's not the story we're trying. That wasn't historic, and that we're not encouraging people to.
Right.
We're not, you know, we didn't hide that it was up there, but the less people that knew about it, the better. Because even today, you know, anyone can go up and see the petrified wood, but we don't put it on the map, or there's no trail to it, and
right.
That's the way it's preserved best.
There's a different park for that.
Yeah, it was a, you know, like over in Zion, there's a huge petrified forest there behind Springdale. Same idea, same rock, same level, same age, but there's no problem with a person going up and exploring around.
Right.
It's not publicized by the park.
Right. That's right. That's right.
It's good. So that's
nice.
With those two items. The only thing I regretted, I mentioned before, was that we really didn't restore the power line coming over from the Weaver Ranch house to the cabin, but that was not an argument that I wanted to push too hard. So,
would you, I guess, would the concept be there was power there when the park took the property over? If there was power there, that meant somebody could actually stay in the building if they wanted overnight. Well, maybe they could anyway without power.
Right.
Well, it's an interesting thought.
And I have to admit, the evolution's not over of the buildings, including those.
Okay.
Which, you know, there are issues that still can come up, and, you know, we have to face. I just thought of another thing. The porch was a flagstone porch out in front of the cabin there.
Right.
And that was put in the probably 60s when they repaired that porch roof. But by the 2000s, it had really disintegrated. The sand, the flagstone, there's enough moisture coming up from below, and it really needed to be replaced because it was a hazard walking across it. And that is that the Johnson family from Marcuson was going to come back and have just an Owen Johnson, the one that I knew the best, his children and grandchildren that I knew, most of them, they were going to have a family picnic there in the spring, and asked what they could do, and I suggested, could we replace the the porch there. And they said, yeah. And so I went over near the Lee's Ferry Lodge. And there was a quarry out there that the BLM still was still approved to use. And
right.
I went out and got a couple truckloads of sandstone slabs and brought them back, had them all stacked up there. And fortunately, one or two of them turned out to be son-in-laws of the grandchildren, or the husbands of the grandchildren, the women. I was really good, experienced stonemasons.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't know it. And they just got going, and all the other men were there, you know, moving the stones for them, and they were chipping them off, leveling them, setting them, and in a couple hours, the whole thing was done.
Wow.
And that was just fabulous. My wife, who knew all these people too, she set up a quilt in the Weaver, or I think it was outside. And the women all got together and tied the quilt. It's, you know, she had it on the frame, and the three layers with the batting in between and all ready to be quilted. And they all sat down, and, you know, in an hour or less than two, they had the whole quilt done.
Wow.
And that, you know, we, Sharon and I provided the material, but that was on the bed in the Samantha cabin for a while, and then we would take it home to protect it, not leave it there for any length of time. But that was examples of how it just keeps changing. And one of the secrets that I had was, you know, preparing in advance. I'd tell people, yeah, I've got permission to do this. Here's the description of the work order of what we're doing and why and how to do it. And but I had started, I had proposed each of these maybe 2 years in advance.
Oh, wow.
Because it had to go through the park, through the headquarters in Page, and get through the archaeologist, and then the approval of the superintendent, and then it was sent to the SHPO in Phoenix, and if they approved it, it would come back, and then I could go out there and do the work. And I have to admit that, you know, it doesn't look good that the park maintenance wouldn't touch anything down there, but to be fair, they didn't have anyone that was going to go through all this prior work to get approval before the job could be done.
So, right. And you want to do it right. And if you see a problem, it's like, well, this is a problem, but we don't have anybody to address it and start the right paperwork that's going to take 2 years to fix it, so I'm just going to ignore it.
Yes. Right. That's what happens.
Yeah,
and,
makes sense.
You know, I have to be fair with that because I did have the time, and I you know, spent a lot of time researching and preparing stuff for things that I knew were going to be 2 years away.
Right, so, right.
You know, and that's just the way that goes. But
so, Alan,
do you have any other comments or questions about the Samantha cabin, which is...
No, I think we're good there. I wanted now to kind of shift gears to the presence of the United States Geological Survey at Lee's Ferry, a presence that now is over 100 years, that's 1923 to 2023.
Yep.
Can you speak to that?
Yeah, I can speak to that a lot.
Good.
because it's really an important part of, and fortunately it was considered one of the historic features of the historic district was the story of the USGS and, you know, after the fact, deserving what was left, which, you know, we talked before about when the dam was built and the USGS was going to completely change their operation down there, then they and the park people ended up bulldozing most of the historic remains of their buildings, which were even more historic because they've been put up by the gold miners. But let me do the other part of the story here.
Okay.
That, and it's back to the Colorado River Compact that, you know, in the very simplistic version, the it became obvious that the Colorado River from Wyoming to Mexico, everybody had designs on it to divert the water and planning and discussing what they would want to do, but there was definitely not enough water for everybody to just do whatever they wanted. And fortunately, they for years were discussing setting the tone for saying somebody's got to do something about the river there. And the Geologic Survey, and you're going to have to put in a lot of the dates exactly because some of it I don't know. I know what resulted, but
okay.
They became, I don't think they demanded to be, but they became the third party intermediary, the referee between the states. As to the states all agreed in the end that the USGS would be the one that would first tell them how much water there is, and then when the group decided how to divide it, they would be the ones to divide it. And they went up and down the river and, you know, just did everything they could, because that was one of their jobs, was determining river and irrigation and all. But very complicated history there. In the end, the states got together. Well, first they asked the U.S. Congress to decide how the water would be divided. They debated a while and said, in all reality, folks, you don't want us deciding. And they turned it back to the states, the seven of them, Wyoming, Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, Nevada, and Arizona, and California, and said, they basically said, send your representatives to a big meeting, and we are going to, in effect, lock the door, and you can't come out without an agreement. And they didn't want to know what was said and how it was battled out, but that's not exactly how it worked, but that was the impression. And they came out dividing Colorado into two parts. The upper Colorado was Utah, New Mexico, Idaho, but Colorado and Wyoming. And the lower basin states were Arizona and Nevada and California. The dividing point, the only practical place to have a dividing point was at Lee's Ferry. And that's why it's such a prominent place in the whole water laws and wars that are still going on to this day. It divided the upper basin to the lower basin. It was the only place they could conveniently get to where the state line crossed that Colorado was really inaccessible wilderness. But there was the road. The bridge was soon to be put in. When they started, the bridge wasn't there, but there was the ferry. It was operating. It was a state highway. You could go from Flagstaff to Lee's Ferry Cross and go up to the North Rim or to Kanab and end up in Salt Lake if you wanted. So it was, and that was the only crossing. And as we told in the interpretation there, in 700 miles of the Colorado River, that was the only crossing. All the way up that height or Hall's crossing, which really wasn't that big a deal, or all the way down at the mouth of the Grand Canyon at Pierce's Ferry. So it was logical to be in there. And the USGS came up and established a camp there and to set up stream gauge. And in those days, they had a real person that gauged the river twice a day. And they measured, you know, how high it was. They could calculate with various formulas that had been agreed upon as to how many cubic feet per second were going down at different days as the flow came and went. It was huge flow in June and July and almost no water in December and January. But they had stream gazers there. They put up tents first. They moved into the fort building, which the miners had lived in before. The Spencer miners, we call them, they had lived in before that. Then built a house for the USGS stream gauger just that'll be northeast of the fort along the road that went to the upper ferry site. And eventually they took over the Spencer's, what we called Spencer's bunkhouse, which is a two-room stone building that was built in the 1890s by the gold miners that were working there. And they lived in, various people lived in that over the years. There was even a schoolhouse in it for the Johnsons and the kids that lived out at Marble Canyon and up at Cliff Dwellers Lodge. But then it was empty at the time, and they moved in there. And then they had quite a construction where they built another home. They had a huge workshop barn, like barn size. They could drive truck and trailer in it and for various repairs, because, I mean, this was an isolated post. You couldn't always count on being able to get to Flagstaff.
Okay.
Even if that's where the office was. And they had to be pretty self-sufficient up there. Not a big auto shop, what amounted to a machine shop, not a, in the old days it would have been a blacksmith shop, but they were machine shops now.
Mm-hmm.
And then down by the old bunkhouse, once they moved into the new home, they converted the bunkhouse into their silt lab. And the thing there is to understand what they were doing, because I got involved a lot with even the modern dream gaugers. They don't live there anymore, but the original stream gaugers in the originally in the 20s, they had a rowboat and they'd row out into the river twice a day and take readings. And the water sample that they would take was kind of like in a quart jar, a milk bottle is what it was back then. You just don't buy milk in the bottles anymore.
Right.
But a quart milk bottle. And it went into this gadget that was shaped like a fish. It was streamlined. The mouth and the front end opened up and you could slide the bottle in there. At the end was kind of a fin. It didn't look, it wasn't mimicking a real fish design, but if you looked at it, you'd say, well, that looks like a fish. And it was made out of brass, so it was heavy. They had to have a kind of a winch to let it down. And when you were at the level you wanted, there was a little string or rope that you could pull that would open the front end, and the bottle would fill up with the water down there. And then you'd close it, haul it up, and take it back in the boat and row it over and take it to the water lab. And in later years, they had cable cars across there. The one tower is still in place above that area upstream from the current gauging station. And they had a cable car, but they would go over at least twice a day and do the water sample. And the reason was, and it's kind of funny, that the water in the river was divided among the upper basin and the lower basin. The lower basin was guaranteed about 12 million acre feet a year, and you'll not get the amount yourself because it kind of varied with different negotiations after that. The upper basin states agreed to send the 12 million down to the lower basin, and anything above that they could use. So, and they, at the time, they thought that was plenty of water for everybody. But the thing was, the lower basin, the Colorado River, most of the year, especially the flood months, was Colorado, red, mud. And a good percentage of the water, the river water, was silt. And in the lower level, sand and mud in the top layers. And whenever you took a sample of the water there and leave this jar, you'd have about 2 inches of sand, an inch of mud, and then maybe a half an inch of this fine deposit that would settle out, and you'd have clear water on top of that just overnight, you know. And the deal was, Arizona and California and Nevada said, you know, we don't want we want 12 million acre feet of water, not sand and mud.
Right.
So every day they had to determine, well, from the day before or however long it took, make the list of how much silt, sand, mud, and how much of the sample was water going down there. And then they agreed on formulas to say how many, you know, cubic feet per second that were going down the river, how much counted as water. So there was a real need for the stream gauger. They were actually sampling the water. And that, well, continues even today. But the stream gaugers and their families, and there were usually one head stream gauger and a couple guys supporting him. So he had days off occasionally. And there were a couple other caretakers that maintained the place up there. When they set this up, the USGS required and got the land around the station up there at Lee's Ferry withdrawn by the Department of Interior from further development or anything. It was, from about where the launch ramp is now, there was basically a fence across there. And actually, it was just beyond where the fort was, where the fence was, and there was a big gate, no trespassing, government property.
Right.
And it was, most of the time you could walk up along the river bank to get to the upper ferry site where people did fishing a lot. But that area was withdrawn. It was USGS property. Stories of families.
If I get this right, the original boat landing that was used in the 40s and 50s was upstream of today's concrete ramp. There's a big Gooding's willow, I think, and that willow is actually still there. It's much smaller. It's sort of stunted down, but that's where they, and there's a little road that leads down to the river there, a little dirt track.
Yeah, and if you remember, in front of the fort, they bladed a large area as a parking area.
Right.
And on the river side of that was a concession there. And right up into the 70s and 80s, there was a guy that had a small trailer there. It was just parked there permanently, and they had electricity to it and water, I guess, and an outhouse somewhere. But he sold the gas for the boats just fishing supplies. This was a fisherman's store, and had a lot of beer and some sandwiches and things for people to, and just tourists that came through would stop there. But right behind that was the road that went down to the river to launch the boats. Wasn't even 15, 20 yards long, but that's where the boat launch was, up there across from the fort building, and you had to kind of drive around this concessionaire, which he required everybody that came up there had to drive by his little place.
Right.
And remember that in the soon after the park got it, another concessionaire officially came in and put a bigger trailer there and also had a motel behind the fort and behind where the restroom is now. There were half a dozen mobile homes manufactured homes that were on concrete block foundations. Each one was, they may have had three rooms, three doors going in, and they were motel rooms. They had, you know, a bed and a bathroom, and they definitely weren't air conditioned, but they probably had swamp coolers.
Mm-hmm.
But that, and then there was this, as that was developed, fortunately, the park put a chain link fence around the fort and the Spencer office to protect them, because they were right in the middle of this whole development. They were the motel right behind the parking lot for the people going upriver, and also for the river trips going down to through the Grand Canyon. So,
Alan, I was just looking at a photo of that workshop. You mentioned the workshop barn.
Yeah.
It was a big structure. When was that bladed down?
That was part of the thing right at, after the park took it over from the Bureau of Reclamation, from the USGS.
Okay.
In that it was part of the bad day when most everything was, all the USGS stuff was bladed down, bulldozed down, piled in the wash there. And you'll have to get an exact date on that, because it was very notorious. Several historians and environmentalists and river runners found out too late that it was going to happen and tried to get it stopped, and even Stuart Udall, who was Secretary of Interior, he tried to get it stopped, but it was too late. Before the anyone knew what happened, it was all gone. The only thing that was left was the what we call the Spencer Bunkhouse, which was they had used as the water sample lab, and the little building next to it, which was the last one built, and it was a guest house that people visiting the site up there from the USGS, they had a place to stay. It was like a motel room, but it was made out of stone. It fit in perfectly. I don't know why they didn't take it down, but I think it was just a new enough building that park people said, well, kind of, we'll find something to do with this.
Okay.
I don't know why, but, you know, this is a
This is really, great, really helpful, because there are some great photos of the Stagegauger's house there at the ferry. And I'm like looking around going, well, where is it? And I can't find it. And so I was thinking, well, maybe this smaller house is it. But as you say, that's the guest house. And that made perfect sense. Okay, thank you.
And the other was a regular, probably, I would guess, two-bedroom kitchen, modern house to the 1930s and 40s is when it was.
Right, with lots of plantings around it. It was a little green oasis there.
And a big covered porch.
Yes.
And there were two buildings like that. And one of them had been built by Spencer as his headquarters and where he stayed.
Okay.
And they moved in there first, and then they built the second one.
So both of those were taken down. Okay.
Were destroyed. All just right. A great tragedy from my point of view. And everyone with Leslie's Ferry.
Okay. All right.
But then when the, it obviously changed, because when the dam was built, suddenly there wasn't any more silt coming down. And technically, they could say, well, just have the Bureau of Reclamation tell them how much water they let out every day, and that's what would be used for the water level.
So, hang on, Alan. I got a question for you. I'm thinking about the 1957 flood. That wasn't a flood. It was a regular sort of 10-year average high water snowmelt.
Yeah.
It got up to 124,000 cubic feet a second.
Right.
That would have been the water content, not the actual flow with silt and sand. Is that right?
Well, no. When they give the, those floods are usually just the actual how many cubic feet per second of mud debris and water.
Right.
They don't really.
So then if you wanted to figure out the actual water content of the flood, you would have to work out the calculations based on the sediment load that they would have a record on. Got it. Okay.
You know, the last few years that I was down there, it changed 180 degrees because then the Park Service and the others came to an agreement to modify the flow of Grand Canyon, of Glen Canyon Dam, to move as much sediment around down in the Grand Canyon with having these big flows periodically, at least once a year. And the problem there that many people pointed out to me, and I then asked river runners that I could, that, was to, the excuse was to restore the habitat for the endangered fish that were a few of them down along the river, and that was good, but in reality, it was to restore the beaches for the river runners, and that was a very real situation because into the, to the turn of the century, to 2000, the huge amount of river runners going down, as you know, these large boats ending up with 60 or more people camping at one beach campsite and virtually every night there'd be a different party coming in to camp at these sites. And quite innocently, when you come up to the beach down in the river, getting out of your boat and walking up across the beach, you're pushing the sand down, and it's a steep thing. You go up typical sandy area, wet sand or the dry parts, and you're going up two steps and sliding down one.
Mm-hmm.
And with that happening day after day with hundreds and hundreds of people, suddenly half of your beach is gone. And after several years of that, there was a noticeable change in what were acceptable beaches for small groups, large groups, and had a major effect. And what the water releases from Glen Canyon to produce a minor flood coming down, the one thing they found was that all the sand was still in the bottom of the Colorado, and the flood came, it stirred it all up, and it moved it downstream, but it only moved it a few miles downstream, and it piled up on and made new beaches down there. So those releases really did have a positive effect on rebuilding the beaches to where they were.
Okay.
And, there were all sorts of other issues involved with it, but
Well, this is real helpful for just thinking about the the buildings that were left to be taken care of, because and I really understand now why everybody was complaining about that bad day when they knocked down these two wonderful
six or eight major historic structures.
Right, including these two wonderful ranch houses, the Spencer House and the USGS main house. Did you know the Tidball family at all? Did you ever get to meet them?
No. Who were they?
Dean Tidball was one of the Gagers that spent time at Lee's Ferry. He and his wife, they had twin daughters, and I did a wonderful chance to interview one of the twins. And they called Lee's Ferry Fairyland.
Yes.
And you may have heard that before. I just found that lovely. They were there in the 50s, and before these buildings were knocked down, and was just a really, it was hot in the summer, sure, but in the winter it was lovely, and they really enjoyed that.
Yeah. So, all right. Just a couple things to complete this whole steam gauging.
Yeah.
They moved the gauge. Well, it had been moved about four or five times, different places along the river from in that area before the Colorado went over the edge of the Paria Riffle there, which was the start of the Grand Canyon. And it ended up there across from the ranger station and the launch ramp, basically, just a little downstream from the launch ramp where the gauging station was. And it was, over the years, automated, improved, made much more scientific. And it now you can visit it online for real-time numbers on how much water is coming down the Colorado, and it has satellite link completely. And the guys come up from Flagstaff probably once a month, go over there just to make sure. They have a cable car that goes across the river there still. But the other gauging station that turned out to be really important was up the Paria at Lonely Dell Ranch.
Okay.
Because when they came up there to Lee's Ferry, they started the one at on the Colorado, but they realized they were right there, and the Paria was putting out major amounts of water, and it was one of the major canyons after, putting water into the Colorado there just below the division point. And so they built a gauging station there, and it was basically just a place where they put in a post with the numbers on it, and they'd drive around there and had access to the farm and went there and make gauges maybe once a week during the most of the year when there were no floods coming. But when they noticed that a flood was coming down the Paria and running high, they would go and gauge the water there a couple times a day during the thing. And it turns out that in the end, it's the most important because of the whole Colorado, all the tributaries. That one of Lonely Dell Ranch is the only one that's in its original place and has been gauged continuously since the 20s. And you can get that gauge information online also. And it's more convenient for them to take the actual flood information down at the bridge that crosses the Paria, going into these ferries.
And the Paria is considered in the upper basin, isn't it?
Well, that became a great debate because no one had talked about that. The lower the state line is way up there, 20 miles, just below Highway 89. But everyone started looking, well, hey, that's a big drainage there, and there's a lot of water coming down the Paria, and whose water is it? What percentage of it, should we say, is upper basin water that they're giving to the south, lower basin, and what part of it is lower basin water that they can keep for themselves? And there was quite a debate for a couple of years, and they came to a formula that so much of it goes into the upper basin and so much to the lowers.
Okay.
As far as the amount of water. But they still have to know how much water they're dealing with. Again, and that's why the gauging is important. And as you probably know, the years that they first arrived, in fact, the first couple of years, ended up being high water years. And they did their best, and they gauged the water, and they told how much water was going by, and that was, just a fact.
Right.
But it turned out that those numbers became critical to dividing the water when it came for the big meeting for the Colorado River Compact. And unfortunately, they made all these deals with a high water level numbers.
Right.
No one did that on purpose. They just, after the fact, people said, well, hey, they should have known that the normal flow was a lot lower than that. But so the whole compact in use between the upper and lower basin had a major flaw in that it was okay as long as it kept raining.
Right.
But
right.
It didn't the last 5 years. So that's part of the issue of basically they're dividing up the river again and saying, who can have so much for what?
Well, one of a number of flaws, another one being that indigenous peoples were not included in that divvying
exactly.
of the water, and neither was Mexico. And
right.
So it's fraught with peril.
The original Colorado Compact was, it was what it was, and it was modified over the years, fortunately. But a lot of the native peoples and tribes got more and more of their share, not completely, all the way down into southern Arizona. But and then it's just a difficult time now where the water has had drought. The river's still flowing, it's there, but you definitely can't use it the same.
Right. Right.
At all. The other, just to finish out the USGS, they built a house with the Park Service up on the Mesa, just south of the campground and launch ramp, where the original ranger station was, and there's probably four or five ranger houses, and that includes maintenance, just park housing is the correct thing. But one of those houses was built by the USGS.
Okay.
And they, in later years, sold that to the Park Service, or there was something. Somehow the park acquired it, and one of the rangers lives in there now. But they even had a little, their built lab that they needed to use was on the end of that house.
Okay.
Off the end of the garage, like it was a built lab.
You know, you've caused another little light bulb to go off in my pea brain, which is when we drive into Lee's Ferry, sort of the road goes past the campground on the left, the river's on the right, and the road climbs up a little bit, and you can see those houses out on this finger of land, and there's the water tower right to the left there, and there's this ranger station. And I always wondered, well, why was that building built there? Again, it was built because the next dam downstream in Marble Canyon was going to flood out the Lonely Dell and the USGS buildings and the launch ramp and the fort and all that structural stuff down there, except that dam was never built. And so here's a ranger station with no purpose. It was closed up, more facilities were then built down on the Paria floodplain.
Yeah.
Closer to the ferry.
That's exactly right. And I like to ask people, you know, why do you think they built them up there? And very, very few people had any idea why.
Mm.
And because, you know, back in the 60s, I was hiking in the canyon at Bridge Canyon Dam site.
Right.
And part of the Sierra Club's battle to prevent any more dams or any dams on the Grand Canyon. And the second dam was up in Marble Canyon and that they were proposing and they were working on. There were crews in there in Marble Canyon, determining the rock, where to put it, how to build what it needed structurally.
Right, Arizona Power Authority was in there in the 60s, you bet. And so I can appreciate that the park made a decision to go ahead and do all that in preparation for what they thought was going to happen.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, a bunch of people looked around and said, wait a minute, you're going to do what? And we're able to stop that.
Right.
Yeah. But now we're heading a little further afield. Yeah, with that makes sense why those buildings were built up there and then never used. So,
right.
Hmm.
Well, the ranger station up there was used.
Was it?
It was for several years. The Glen Canyon Ranger, and there was a contact station there where visitors could come in. There was an interpreter. And we would give out information and maps and things, explain what to do, but when
this is the ranger station by the water tower.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that was used for many years.
Okay.
And then Grand Canyon built their office down closer to the launch ramp because that's what they did. They were there to monitor the launch ramp going south, going downstream.
Right.
So they needed their office there.
And didn't they just bring in a couple trailers for that?
Oh, no. There's right now, there's a beautiful...
Oh, yeah. Now there is. But I mean, their initial stake down there on the Paria Delta was some trailers, wasn't it?
Yeah. Right. And so those have all been replaced with permanent structures.
Right.
So that's.
But it's funny because that ranger station by the water tower, as you mentioned, where there were interpretive ranger and there were a sort of a visitor's center, if you will, people would stop and walk over and get information. That was shut down, but nothing replaced it.
Right. It's been discussed to have seasonal rangers to live there. In other words, have one more park housing But that was a problem because it's really set up to the roadway and the parking lot and all this set up to be like for the public to go in, and this is a public building, and notoriously park people live in those places and they don't have a minute's rest for
right.
people pounding on the door wanting to know this or help with that.
You wouldn't want the public to go ahead and park that close to residents where they could just walk over there if there wasn't anybody over here and start pounding on doors to get answers to questions.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's just was one of the reasons. I don't know why. I think it's because there were no funds for extra staff down there.
Mm. Right.
They're low on staff, so they're not going to get the funds to build new housing. So that's that one. So
okay.
We're.
Well, it is interesting because I think as tourists drive in and kind of drive around trying to figure out what is the interpretation of Lee's Ferry,
mm-hmm.
There is kind of no centralized place they can go. There's Lonely Dell over there. They got to know to drive over there, to drive up that road, and there's
yeah.
a gate, and what do they do then? And then there's the ferry, and there's some buildings, and there's a couple of interpretive signs by the buildings, and that's that.
Yeah.
So it's kind of very much self-directed.
It is, definitely. The one place that they tried to do that, to solve that problem, is out at Navajo Bridge, because virtually everyone coming along 89A would stop at Navajo Bridge and either use the restroom, go through the store, and there was a ranger there, and it was presented as kind of like a visitor center.
Okay.
And the people in there would encourage people to go down to Lee's Ferry.
Got it.
If they were going out to the North Rim or the South Rim, they said, it's worth going down there. The main thing I always emphasize, it's the only place you can drive to the Colorado River in the canyon.
Right.
So you're going to the South Rim, the North Rim, looking down into that thing, just 5 miles down the road, you can drive down and walk down and put your foot in the water.
Right,
and
besides
really
Diamond Creek.
Really encouraged a lot of people to do it, and then they'd find out all the other interesting things
right.
on the way.
Okay, cool.
It's not an easy place to interpret.
No, and when I think of the Navajo Bridge Interpretive Center, I think of Navajo Bridge. I don't think of the Navajo Bridge and Lee's Ferry Interpretive Center.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. It is what it is. And,
yeah.
Yeah. Excellent. We have been visiting for about an hour here. I still have lots of questions about how you salvaged the USGS buildings there by the launch ramp. What work you did on those. So if you're willing, let's pick this up again, and we'll put a comma here in this interview series.
Okay.
All right, well, this will conclude part 21 of A Grand Canyon Oral History with Alan Malmquist. Today is Friday, August 25th, 2023, and Alan, thank you so very much.
Thank you.